This is Colourful Radio.
I'm here in the beautiful Staffordshire countryside. Is it Staffordshire?
Just about Staffordshire, yeah.
Just about. With Nick Hancock, television presenter, Morrison's man, comedian, and country lover. But most importantly, of course, a Stoke City supporter.
Yes, that sort of defines me, and I'm not upset by that. Other people would be upset and say, for goodness sake, dig a bit deeper, but that's about as deep as you can dig.
Let me ask you this. I think it was Kierkegaard, or possibly Kierkegaard. Sorry, trucking pun. No.
An assonant pun.
Yes. Is the long throw a legitimate football tactic?
Of course it's a legitimate football tactic. Naturally it is. It's been done for many, many, many years. Ian Hutchinson in the early 70s. It's been forgotten and rediscovered. Like Tutankhamun.
Perhaps you'd explain to our listeners who I'm referring to.
You're referring to Rory Delap, who was our midfield player, who takes very long throws and we keep scoring goals from them, and people get a little bit cross and a little bit upset and go, it's not fair, and bleat and blart like pigs under the wheels of a big truck.
Yes, because let's face it, it's not Barcelona, is it?
It isn't Barcelona, but I noticed Barcelona have a long throw expert as well.
Do they?
Yeah, he's not in the side.
OK, now, let's just dispense with Stoke quickly. Yeah. Stoke, what is all this about Stoke supporters being the greatest supporters in the land? What is this addiction to Stoke? Why have Stoke supporters kept them up?
It's purely, it's something that now, everything in football is so minutely observed and recorded and saved for posterity. And so even the decibel levels of crowds are recorded by Sky and the BBC, and they've latched onto the fact that the Britannia Stadium is louder than anywhere else. And the club has sort of played on that quite cleverly and said, we need you and you're making the difference. And so it's been a good thing, all in all.
So they finished 12th. Were you surprised by how...
I was absolutely stunned. I couldn't be more surprised than when my wife told me she was pregnant with our second child. It was absolutely incredible.
I won't ask you why you're surprised about that.
I've been in prison for 3 years.
Okay. So what was it about Stoke that, you know, I mean, were they particularly bad? Were you expecting them to be relegated?
No, it's not a rich club. It didn't have particularly fashionable players. I don't think there are many players in our side that other teams would want, but they just showed a great work ethic, and surprised us all, surprised me. And also, of course, I presume that we do very, very badly because they're part of my life, and I always presume that my life will go very badly.
Doesn't seem to be going too badly,
does it? No, it doesn't. It's just, I'm afraid, part of the nature of who I am.
How did you become a comedian?
I'd gone from university and I'd done a lot of comedy there.
Which university was this?
I was at Cambridge. I'd done a lot of comedy there, but had decided that this was...
Footlights.
Footlights. I was president of the Footlights and all that stuff. But I decided this definitely wasn't for me and applied for many, many, many jobs that seemed to fit, advertising being amongst them, and I'd ended up getting a job in advertising, which I have to say I didn't particularly like. I very much liked the people I worked with, but didn't like the
job.
Where
did you work?
I worked at Saatchi and Indeed Saatchi.
Did you?
Yeah, where I was treated like a dog.
Oh, surely not.
but what happened was that a guy who I'd been at college with, called Neil Malarkey,
yeah,
was in a double act with somebody who you may have heard of called Mike Myers.
Indeed.
And Mike got an offer to go back to Canada to perform for Second City, who were a big sort of comedy improv group in Canada that used to feed Saturday Night Live and things like that, and as you can see, that worked for him. And they had a few gigs booked, and Neil said, look, come and fill in, and we'll write a double act set, and so I sort of did that concurrently with working at Saatchi, who I have to say I worked for 6 months to the day, because I was told you weren't allowed to have anything on your CV that was less than 6 months, and I left exactly 6 months after I started.
So you were the guy who stood in for Mike Myers?
I was the guy that stood in
for the good guy who stood in for Austin Powers.
Exactly so. That's exactly who I was, although we weren't to know that Mike was going to be so fantastically successful then, but that was quite a nice way to start.
Did you know Mike Myers?
Yeah, I knew Mike, yeah.
And do you ever, you still in touch with him at all?
No. I have seen him occasionally. He played cricket with us once.
Did he?
Rather fantastically, yeah. When he came over, because he knew lots of people on the circuit, you know, like me and other people. And he came over when he was publicising one of his big, big films. And he wanted to see some of us, and he'd heard we were playing cricket. He said, hey, I'll come and play. And turned up in this ludicrous stretched limo at some poxy little cricket club in southwest London and played quite badly, I have to say.
Now, we've come to that part of the little chat when it's time for your first dessert on Duck Island, Nick.
Absolutely.
Now, you've chosen as your first dessert banana split, which I have to say I've put together myself, and we may have seen a better one. And I've also got to say that although I've supplied the vanilla ice cream and the banana, which is looking a bit sorry, you insist on having some toppings, so you've got a chocolate and a strawberry topping of your own.
Yeah.
Try it, Nick. Go for it. You've also got a glass of dessert wine. What is that?
No, it isn't a glass of dessert wine. It's a glass of Chablis.
Oh, a glass of Chablis. Okay,
I'm going to have some.
Here we go. Okay.
Right, this looks fantastic. Well, it doesn't look fantastic, actually. It looks pitiful, to tell you the honest truth. But I'm hoping it'll taste fantastic. Yeah, that'll do it. That'll do it.
Now, where does this ice cream come from, Nick?
The ice cream itself?
Itself. Morrison's. Now, this is a true story. I arrived in Stoke to interview Nick. And I think this is commendable. And I said to Nick, I need to stop at the supermarket. And he said, guessing properly, that I hadn't brought the desserts properly for Duck Island, which, of course, is in Stoke, as you'll be aware. And he said, we can't go to Sainsbury's. We'll have to go to Morrison's. As you may know, Nick, of course, is the spokesman for Morrison's on a lot of commercials. So we did, and I thought it was very, very honourable of you.
Thank you very much.
Anyway, how does that rate?
It's very, very good, actually, I have to say. The toppings are particularly good because they're my own. But it's a fine banana. It's one of the best bananas I've had. Wonderful ice cream. And the three things together, they're all just bliss.
This is Colourful Radio.
Yes, this is Colourful Radio. This is the Saturday Salmagundi with me, Toby Kell-Hyphenog, and the Argettes, of course. And now, back to Duck Island Desserts. So we're back here with Nick Hancock on Duck Island Desserts. Now, Nick, have we gone back, do you think? Because what everybody talked about was we had alternative comedy, which signified a break between the kind of Bob Monkhouse school of comedy, if you like, the slick professional comedian. And then alternative came in the guise of Ben Elton and Dom French and that kind of thing. Do you think that we've now, that cycle's completed and we now need another new kind of comedy?
I haven't a clue.
Thank you, can't say that.
Some of that.
Yeah. No. Seriously, what do you think?
I mean, I don't know. It's not. I don't think we've had enough of the history of comedy to work out how the cycles are going to work. But yeah, alternative comedy was alternative in lots and lots and lots of different ways, in that it didn't have formal joke shapes, it didn't have formal punchlines, it attempted to be non-sexist, non-racist, non-judgmental, really. It was less concerned about other taboos, however, taboos of language, of society. Yeah, I suppose it's changed a little bit. People get used to stuff, and comedy's always about subverting stuff, so you're always going to get things that kick against the pricks.
Did you like being a comedian?
I loved being a comedian, but I didn't realise how much I liked being a comedian until I'd given it up for quite a long time, and then did a couple of sort of 5-minute slots and thought, oh, this is good. What a buzz this is. But at the time, I suppose, like so many things that give you a buzz, if you're doing it all the time, you perhaps don't appreciate it quite so much.
Did you have any rough rides as a comedian when you started out, with people not laughing?
Right at the very beginning, it went particularly well. I think it's when you get a bit lazy that you get caught out, because audiences are quite adept at reading you and reading your lack of commitment to them, if you like. And so it's in some ways, unless your materials are absolutely awful, if you've got the level of excitement still, this is before you get professional enough to put that on, and heaven knows that is what being an experienced comedian is making everybody feel like they're hearing the joke for the first time. It's if you dip below your standards, audiences are very good at catching you out in that.
So why did you stop?
I stopped because I had an awful lot of other work on, and to tell you the honest truth, at the time you were doing about 7 gigs a week. I've been doing it for about 5 or 6 years. It felt like a great gift to be able to stop. It's quite a difficult thing to go back and do. It's I've 2 big regrets I have in my life. I think giving up stand-up comedy and stopping playing football when I was about 33. I really regret, because I know that both of them are things that I can't go back to.
Why could you go back to being a comedian?
Because I don't think I have that fitness. I think it's the same for both of them, whether it be mental fitness or physical fitness. And also, I don't think I'm young enough to have the patience to learn it again. Because also, in the same way that when you've done something that you feel you did fairly proficiently, to go back and do it less proficiently is too upsetting.
But surely, if you were to go back and be a comedian again, you'd just have a different story to tell. You'd be talking about life from a different point of view. Why wouldn't that be just as valid?
Because I think one of the things that when I was younger is that you only had one voice. You know, there was that arrogance of youth, and you know, almost all youth has it that. That's when you think that the things that your parents say are ridiculous and all the things that all your friends say are wonderful and true and wise and funny. And what you do is you go out and say those things and you find there's lots of other people that think the same. I find it frightening because I've been young and I've been unmarried and I've been married and I am old and I've been through all of those things. I'm not quite sure which are the things that would resonate anymore.
The things that would resonate, surely, are the people who'd have the shared experience. I mean, the point is, when you go out, surely at 22 or 23 or 25, you're talking about people to people who've got the same experience, yeah, and relate to what you're saying.
Well, and I'm happy with that. It's fine. They're regrets, but they're regrets I now know I can do nothing about. So that's absolutely fine.
I think it's very interesting that you seem to be
treading water.
No, modest. I had to get out of you something that I knew, that you were at Cambridge Footlights, and you've been president of the Cambridge Footlights, yeah? Which is on so many people's CVs who've done very well as comedians. I mean, I was listening to a radio programme where Clive Anderson was interviewing John Lloyd the other day,
yeah,
and it did feel vaguely incestuous to me, mm-hmm, because everybody that they knew had all basically come through the same process, yeah, as it were. They'd all been to Cambridge or to Oxford, they'd, yeah, you know, da-da-da. And you seem very reluctant to be part of that.
Well, I mean, certainly when I first started, that was absolutely the worst thing that you could have been doing. I mean, I was starting just after the first boom, the comic strip. You know, and if you remember the young ones, it was Footlights, College, Oxbridge. You know, this was the worst thing. And I had the great gift of having a vague accent that didn't make me sound like I was from the South, and so I could easily pass it off because people were perfectly willing to believe that I'd been down the pit since I was 16. It would have been just the worst thing to have gone up and said, "Hello, very, very pleased to meet you. My name is Nick Hancock. I was president of the Cambridge Footlights." That would not have gone down well. And so I've never sort of lost that. But also, I am of that age that you know, bad, I don't know. I'm English, for one, and two, brought up in the last vestiges of punk. And so, therefore, all of those things are clenchingly embarrassing.
Did you feel part of Cambridge when you were there? You weren't a sort of working class outsider.
No. But because of the fact I wasn't a working class outsider, I'm just saying that was the role I had to play. No, not at all. I loved it. I had a fantastic time. I am a fairly simple soul, and I liked being in a very beautiful place, which Cambridge is, and I liked playing lots of football and cricket on lots of lovely football and cricket pitches. In fact, I had to do a few exams as well, by the by.
Right, time for Nick's second dessert. Nick is now having his second dessert. Now, he did ask for coconut ice cream, and that was beyond me.
Yeah.
So I bought a Bounty, which has got coconut ice cream in it.
I have to say that the level of effort that you've put into this has been very, very low.
Well, you say that.
You've turned up with a banana and a Bounty ice cream so far.
Well, OK.
But I'm sure most people know what a Bounty ice cream is like, but I'll still tell you.
OK, well, it's just part of the... OK.
Chocolatey outside.
Yeah, and...
coconutty ice cream inside.
Yes, you see, that's Mark. I actually, you know, I'm very fond of a Bounty. Not everybody likes... No. Not everybody likes them, is there?
Oh, I love a Bounty. Again, as you get older, not so good teeth-wise. You know, you get lots of the little bits in your teeth. Very good.
Very good. OK, so we've had the second dessert on Duck Island with Nick Hancock. He's had a Bounty.
This is Colourful Radio.
Back now with Nick Hancock for the third part of Duck Island Desserts. Nick's had his two first desserts, marvellously prepared. Banana split that I did, marvellous. And a Bounty, which I have to say took less preparation. Now, Nick, you've been a comedian, so how did you end up on the telly?
Well, they discovered the great transition of how to get stand-up onto television and radio. It took them a long time to work out, I have to tell you. And the answer was, of course, panel shows. And so panel shows became the staple diet, I think.
But wasn't all that begun, really, with I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue? Wasn't that the beginning, the sort of genesis of all this stuff?
Yeah, but I think it was the idea that actually I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue had done it, and you could actually do the same thing, but just with different subjects. I think that was probably the breakthrough that people made. And although I have to say that They Think So Level was the first panel game I ever did, and the first time I did it on television, although it had been on radio originally. The sainted Des Lynam was the presenter.
All right, so they hired you to do that programme.
I was doing a programme called Room 101, which I did on
was
radio.
Was that first?
Yeah.
So Radio Room 101 started.
I did not Radio 5. It was my idea. And well, my idea with Liz Revens and someone else.
Can I ask you a question about Room 101? Because I never quite understood this about Room 101. I think it was your idea. I can blame you. I always thought that Room 101 was the place where the rats were, isn't it?
It is the place where the rats were. But
sorry, let's just explain to you, people who don't know. In 1984, it was the last place on Earth
you'd want to go. In the book, 1984.
Yes. Sorry, in the book, 1984, it was the very last place you'd ever want to go because all your fears were there.
Exactly.
That's right?
Yes. So the rat was Winston Smith's personal least favourite thing, thing that he feared the most.
Yes.
Obviously, we couldn't go for fear so much, so we just allowed people to choose the things that might be in their Room 101. If they were to be arrested by the thought police and tortured, what were the things that would successfully elicit responses from them? What things would be good things to torture them with? That was the very, very rough and quite honestly bogus idea we had.
You've started doing this, and of course, originally, I think, it was Rory McGrath, wasn't it? Yeah. And Lee Hurst?
Lee Hurst, yeah.
And it went very well, didn't it, from the beginning?
It went tremendously well. I mean, you know, I always say, if you're lucky enough to be in one successful series in your career, that's pretty good, and if you can do two...
But it's a sort of Midlands mafia, wasn't it? Because you had David Gower and Gary Lineker, both from Leicester, weren't they?
No, David played for Leicestershire. Okay, the man who was in King's College Canterbury, I believe.
Okay. And then what happened? Lee Hurst pulled out. Why did he pull
Lee
out?
Lee left. Lee wanted to carry on doing stand-up. I don't think he felt completely comfortable. I mean, people may not remember this at the time, it was pretty massive. It became a very big show very quickly, and I think Lee was trying to set up his own comedy club and wasn't sure that he was enjoying it as much as he might do. You know, people always presume if things are a great success that they're necessarily enjoyable. Well, yeah, if you're into that, they are, but they can also become a bit of a shock. And so Lee left, and then we found this little-known radio presenter called Jonathan Ross to come to.
Well, this is interesting, because Jonathan Ross, I mean... Of course, it had a huge beginning to his career when he'd done the original, I can't remember what it was called now.
The Last Resort.
The Last Resort, which is in fact Friday Night with Jonathan Ross.
Yeah.
Called The Last Resort on Channel 4.
Yeah.
That's how he came to public attention.
Yeah.
He'd done terribly well, and then they dropped it, didn't they, I think. I don't know what happened, but they kind of disappeared from view. And in a sense, you resurrected Jonathan Ross's career.
Well, not me. I mean, I think he was coming back to do a number of things, but I would have said that definitely I Think It's All Over was the highest profile.
Well, that was the beginning, because at that point he just wasn't the name he is today, and it sort of took off again from there, didn't it?
No, and Jonathan, I mean, I have to say, and I have no reason particularly to stick up for Jonathan, he's an incredibly hard-working person. When you think that he does his film show, he does his Friday show, he was at the time doing They Think It's All Over, he does his Saturday radio show. He's incredibly hard-working. He's incredibly hard-working in a genre and in style that must be exhausting, because he uses up an awful lot of himself. And he's loquacious, yes, but he's also intelligent and insightful and stimulating, I think. And I would, you know, I have three people I've met in my life, all of whom, interestingly enough, I think their greatest medium is radio, and that, I mean that as someone who loves radio. I would put Jonathan Ross and Danny Baker and Chris Evans together as three fantastically talented people in that medium, and in other mediums too. And interestingly enough, of course, they've all worked together, you know, so that's they're an interesting threesome.
I don't think you meant that. He's obviously missed somebody out.
And you, of course.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. God's sake. Now, we are now on to Nick's third favourite dessert. Well, not necessarily in order, but the third of his favourite desserts to be taken on to Duck Island. He's chosen fresh raspberries, and we're having a bit of a dispute here, because I'm insisting I bought these from Morrison's, and he doesn't believe me.
Well, no, I buy all my raspberries from Morrison's.
Are you telling me you actually personally go round Morrison's checking up on their food now, as well as doing commercials?
Yeah, I do it quite a lot. I've got a lot of time on my hands.
Good-natured fruit, it says here. Ravishing raspberries, lovingly raised in tune with Mother Nature, without using pesticides.
How did you get it from the organic method?
Probably. How's it going?
They're very good. I mean, I love raspberries. You can't beat them.
You can't beat them.
Right. And they're from Scotland, and I love Scotland too.
Do you know what, though? I've noticed with raspberries, there's two things I want to point out about it. One, they're not kosher.
Are they not?
Don't ask me why. Well, I do know why, actually. Because these
they're
bits...
sprayed in something.
No, they face out. These seed bits face out for some reason. For some reason, they're not kosher. I know that. And the other thing... what else can I tell you about? Oh, yes. They're firmer than they used to be.
I was going to say the opposite, you see.
What?
I was going to say that these are slacker.
Ah.
And there you go.
Obviously brought up on Stafford to Rock.
Well, no, I just remember, you know, many the days before Alton Towers, many an afternoon going to the fruit farm and picking strawberries and going down the hedgerows and picking raspberries until you were sick. And they were always quite much.
Where did you do that?
Oh, round here.
Okay, raspberries. Do you like raspberries?
I love them.
Had to rank these three desserts you've had on Duck Island, the raspberries, you're only allowed to take one. I mean, we didn't do this in the previous episodes, by the way, but we'll do it now.
Yeah.
Which one would you take with you?
It's a tough one, isn't it?
It is.
I mean, I didn't know I was in for this sort of a grilling.
No. Well, I'll tell you what, we'll leave it to the next bit.
Raspberries.
Marvellous. Raspberries. He's gone for raspberries. We're back in a minute with the final part of Duck Island Desserts.
This is Colourful Radio.
Right, we're back with Nick Hancock for the final part of Duck Island Dessert. He's now eating two together. He's now eating the sloppy remains of the banana split. He likes all this. Right, now, let me ask you this. You've had this tremendous career. You've had a lot of success. In a sense, it seemed to have stopped. Why is that? What happened, exactly? Because you now seem to retire to the country.
A bit of both. I mean, a bit of... that's raspberries aren't good. I think it's all over. We've done 18 series, and I think they felt... I blame Angus Dean for this. They felt it wanted... spicing up, and the easiest thing was to get rid of the man in the middle.
Oh, I see.
Which they'd already done once and found that it worked.
Yeah.
So they got rid of me, but I think only for one series, and then they packed it up.
So it was all over. They thought it was all over, and it was all over.
I sort of stopped doing stuff for a bit, and rather enjoyed it, and thought I just don't have that desperate. Well, I never really had a desperate desire to do it, but I didn't have I just wasn't bothered. I wasn't missing it that much, and I quite like to do a little bit of work to earn the money, but I'm very happy doing what I'm doing. And it always sounds so disingenuous. It always sounds like I'm saying I want to go home and spend more time with my family. But actually, I wanted to go home and spend more time with my family. And having done it, unlike lots of people who are very career-orientated, I found that actually I really, really like doing that. I've always thought that I'd pack up at 50, and I'm just about there anyway.
Now, why this tremendous attachment to Stoke? We're coming full circle now. We're going back to the football match, but you live near Stoke.
Yep.
What is it about Stoke?
Well, I mean, it's where I was brought up. And
yeah, but lots of people don't live where they're brought up. Most people don't, in fact.
No, that's because they're shallow and don't have any loyalty. Because I love the team, and the team's always been part of my life. And I spend an awful lot of time when people say where or why or how, defending it, and I think I've probably convinced myself that it was a good place.
So the first Stoke that you watch... Was it, I'm trying to get this right chronologically, was it the Stoke of, wasn't the Stoke of George Eastman, Dennis Violet, was it?
Banks, Marsh, Pedgick, Bernard Smith, Law, Connery, Greenough, Richie Derbing, Eastman.
Just go back, just go Banks. Yes, go there.
Marsh, John Marsh.
Don't remember him.
Mike Pedgick,
yes, remember him.
Alan Bloor. Dennis Smith,
of course. Did he go on to manage Sunderland?
He did, indeed.
Yeah. Was Tony Waddington the manager?
He was, indeed.
Now, the thing about Stoke is, they'd been the Stoke of Stanley Matthews.
Yes.
They'd sort of disintegrated, and then Tony Waddington came back to manage them, and he brought Stanley Matthews back.
Yeah, he came to manage them and brought Stanley Matthews back, yeah.
Yeah, and then they had this great revival, and used to play very, very good football, and brought people like Dennis Violet back to the team.
They did, indeed. I'm very impressed by your knowledge.
So then, they disappeared into oblivion again, but you kept with them all the time, did you?
Yeah, they just went into oblivion briefly and then came back again under Anne Durbin, and then they did disappear into oblivion many years.
And we were supporting them all the time.
Oh, yeah.
And you'd rather stand the terraces and have the banter, as it were, than go and watch somebody famous, because you're not all fabulous. You're not that far from Manchester here, are you? I mean, there must be a lot of Stoke supporters who've gone to support Manchester United, but they're not. You're only 30 or 40 miles away, aren't you?
And you'd say that in my house.
You wouldn't support Manchester?
No.
Ever?
No. It's
but there must be people around here who do.
Yeah, I'm sure there are, but, you know, as far as it's a non-question. It's like saying, who's your second team? I don't understand. That doesn't compute. No.
Oh, I'm sorry. You see, I've had several teams, so I know all
about it.
That's completely fair, because I grew up a Brighton supporter.
Yeah.
And then I have to say, I hoard around Queen's Park Rangers and then Tottenham for different reasons. I stopped going to Rangers because I hated the AstroTurf.
Yeah.
And once you've done that, you can never feel fully that you are a proper supporter. You can try, but you can never go back, can you? You've got to stick with one team.
Yeah, and you've got to earn it.
You have to. So you feel as though now the good times, the victories over Arsenal and what have you, are sort of reward for the defeats against whoever it was.
Well, do you know, actually, funny enough, but my whole perspective has changed. It should be like that, but the weird thing is that this season has been completely different, because this is the first season that my son has got it.
Oh, right.
And I've been taking him for years, and he's suddenly become you know, absolutely obsessed, you know, and I, he sends me off to get the hot dogs, whereas usually he'd be any excuse to not be watching, he'd be going to get the hot dogs. And he's just become...
How old is he?
He's become a monster. He's 8.
Oh, yes, about 8. Okay, yeah. So now... And he's got the striped shirt, he goes...
He has everything, and, you know, and he just comes in and tells me everything that he's seen on, you know, Sky Sports News, you know, endlessly telling me.
And next year, is it going to be second season, second album, second novel, blues, or are they going to survive?
It may well be. No.
What do you think?
Let's see who we buy in the summer.
They didn't pay $80 million for Cristiano Ronaldo, I saw.
They didn't spend $80 million on Cristiano. He's not our sort of a player.
Oh, no, you would say no, would you, if he turned up?
I think so. He hasn't got the work.
If he turned around and said, I've always wanted to play for Stoke, they'd turn away.
But you know that any of them, if they only spoke what was in their heart, would say that.
Of course.
Because if they have a soul, deep down, they're a Stoke fan.
All right. Nick, we've come to the end of this now, and I'm going to ask you a couple of questions. The first question is, do you know who Berris Hammond is?
Berris Hammond?
Yes.
I don't think I do, off the top of my head.
Well, OK. Berris Hammond, you're not alone, because I asked this question of everybody. Yeah. Anne Winnicombe didn't know, Julie Birchall didn't know, Alan Parker didn't know,
right.
Jonathan Aitken didn't know, so you're all in very, very, very good company.
Right.
But I ask it because he is typifies the music we play here on Carlisle right. Radio. He is one of the great reggae singers. Listen to him, because honestly, he's marvellous. But he's one of these guys who you can't quite work out why he isn't being played, you know,
yeah,
across
widely.
The,
no.
And I can't understand it. Anyway, that's the first. The second question is, my new question is, do you know the meaning of eleemosynary?
Eleemosynary? No, I don't know the meaning.
No, okay. That, don't worry, because you're in good company.
No,
too. This came up because Anne Widdecombe, in an interview, used the word amazingly in conversation, and I did have the wit to turn around. I've got to give myself... At least I didn't go pretend I didn't know what she was... You know, up to I understood, which I didn't. And anyway, eleemosynary is E-L, I think, I-M... No... Maybe it isn't. It's something. I've lost the spelling now. E-L-E-E-M or something. And what it means is giving in a charitably or done with a charitable purpose or something.
Oh, right.
And it's a word that only Anne Widdecombe can ever have used in...
altruistically, though.
Same sort of thing. Yes, I suppose. Yeah, yeah. Please don't go any deeper than that. Okay. Anyway, that's the second question. So you've not done too badly because you didn't know the answer either of them.
Yeah.
Nick, one last thing. You're on Duck Island. You're allowed to take with you any woman or man of your choice.
Yeah.
Who would you take with you?
I take Anne Widdecombe.
Would
so
you?
I could beat her to a pulp, but altruistically, or is it elements?
Elemosynarily. I don't know if there's an adverb for elemosynary. Anyway, marvellous. Oh, that's fantastic. Nick, we're shaking hands. Thank you very much. Thank you. Nick Hancock, this week's guest on Duck Island Desserts.
This is Colourful Radio.